Hello and welcome to our Post-Shine VIP special guest series. And this is an extremely special one because I get the pleasure of talking to my dear friend Donna Gates. And Donna has been someone that I started following long ago when I first started doing this work in the alternative and holistic community functional medicine and nutrition. And I just fell in love with her book, The Body Ecology Diet. And it is a great joy for me to get to meet her in person a couple of years ago and get to be friends with her. She is a dear, wonderful person. So let me tell you a little bit about her formally. She's the international best-selling author of several books. One is The Body Ecology Diet, Recovering Your Health and Rebuilding Your Immunity. Most of us know that book and have read that book or at least referred to that book. I've sent lots of patients and clients to that book. She's also got The Body Ecology Guide to Growing Younger, Anti-Aging Wisdom for Every Generation. She's on a mission to change the way the world eats. The Body Ecology Diet was indeed the first of its kind. It was sugar-free, gluten-free, casein-free, and probiotic-rich. That's more common now. There's a lot of diets out there that kind of follow in that footsteps, but she was the first to talk about that. And from my own personal experience, I remember reading the book and realizing how sane it was because of the 80-20 rule and everything in balance and moderation. And it was really, really effective for the people that I worked with it on. So in 1994, Donna championed the natural sweetener stevia into the U.S., and now it's all over the place, thanks to Donna's beginning that. She began teaching about fermented foods and talking about what she coined the phrase inner ecosystem that now is becoming popularly known as the microbiome, but she was talking about it long before it became a dinner table conversation. She's really passionate about introducing the microbes to the gut and making sure that we're maintaining that because we realize that that's so connected to everything. And our conference Shine was really about one piece of that, which was the gut-brain connection and how what's going on in the gut affects the brain, the mood, the cognition, attention, et cetera. And one thing I want to add is that Donna is very active in the autism community, and she has a program called Bedrock to help parents of autistic children get their children's health and ecology in order so that they can have improvements in autism. So Donna, I'm just so thrilled to have you here. She's also a completed advanced fellow in the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. I know she's active in the Institute of Functional Medicine in A4M. So Donna, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to be with us today.
Well, once we met and became friends, I admire you so much, Marie. You have amazing energy. And just your information is so fantastic. So I'm really honored that we are friends and that you asked me to be on here. So hopefully I can contribute. I was thinking, you know, what could I say that I always like to, add information that people haven't already heard about before. And so, you know, I thought about it for a while yesterday and today, and I have several things I want to talk about today. So hopefully, we can do that, and hopefully it's really valuable information for people.
Well, I know it always is, because one thing that always impresses me is you're ever researching and digging. And I love that about you, that you want to share things that aren't naturally, you know, always talked about. And even listening to your gut summits and the way you interview people and really get to things that most people don't get to. So, yeah, where do you want to start?
Well, you know, I was thinking, people never think of the teeth as part of our digestive tract. We always think it starts sort of at the stomach, small intestine, large intestine, but there's things happening in our mouth that are so absolutely critical. And it's really, you know, kind of interesting to me how we're created and what nature's done to make us like we are. But, you know, chewing, like we have teeth in our mouth, and they're there for a purpose. They're not just to keep white and look pretty and give us a pretty smile. Their main function is to chew up food, and I don't think people chew well. I think people probably did a long, long time ago because food was so precious that once you got some, you savored it. And we have the sensation, like we smell and we can taste and we can look at some food. And imagine if you just worked really hard to grow some vegetables and now finally they were available and you can eat them, how priceless and precious they would be to you. So when you put them in your mouth, you would use all your senses, your sense of smell. You look at a beautiful color. They may even have wonderful textures to them, but you would have put them in your mouth with a real sense of gratitude. And everybody talks about eating mindfully, but I think we all intellectually get that, but I don't think we understand, we don't practice it, and I don't think there's some things that we really we'd be better about practicing if we understood a few things. So I wrote down some notes, and it's very interesting to me that the teeth are in the mouth, because chewing, the very act of chewing, actually activates the neurological pathways in the brain. So as we chew, the brain is being activated. And so people that eat fast and swallow their food quickly and don't even think about what they're eating, which is an awful lot of people, they're going to put on more weight. There's actually an interesting, quite a lot of research on this, that if you eat fast, don't chew well, your weight's going to go up. And what happens is your blood sugar goes up. And if you eat slowly, then your blood sugar is much more stable. And as you know, and I've taught so often, Rita Marie, the blood sugar is critical. I mean, if we want to age well and keep infections under control and get the right kind of energy into our mitochondria, controlling blood sugar is absolutely essential. Yes. So eating slowly, chewing thoroughly, that's really like 30 to 40 chews is a must. And so the teeth are part of the digestive tract, but they're actually in there activating the brain. And if you chew, if you'll chew that 30 to 40 times, you're going to literally weigh less and you're going to control your blood sugar. Now, we always talk about the gut-brain connection. But very people talk about this big, important nerve that runs between the brain and the gut brain. I mean, we have this entire nervous system in our gut that's doing just as many things and more things even than the brain in our head. And they're linked together by this big nerve called the vagus nerve. So if you're, the vagus nerve does many, many things, but chewing activates the vagus nerve. And in Chinese medicine, I always found it really interesting when I studied Chinese medicine years ago that, you know, the different organs that they pair together, like they'll pair, liver, gallbladder, heart, small intestine, stomach with the spleen and pancreas, more digestive functions, adrenals, kidneys, all that are paired, with bladder. But they pair the lungs and large intestine with each other. And over the years, I've really appreciate the wisdom. I don't even know how Chinese medicine came about. I don't think currently alive people or people that lived hundreds of years ago really even developed Chinese medicine. I think it came from another civilization in time, but it's just so amazingly accurate. But the lungs and large intestine are very much paired together. So when we breathe, it relaxes the vagus nerve. And that then relaxes the large intestine. So if you're eating quickly and you're not chewing very well, and your weight's going up and your blood sugar's going up, well, your body is forced to put more insulin into the bloodstream to get that blood sugar into the cells. And of course, then we become insulin resistant. So we have all this extra insulin out. We can develop diabetes, which they say that by the time everybody's in their 70s and 80s, most all of us will have diabetes. You know, and people think, oh, diabetes, that's a really not a good thing. I'm going to have to take insulin. But, you know, diabetes is way more than that. Diabetes is about blindness and macular degeneration and heart disease. And so if you don't protect yourself and you do, you know, go toward diabetes, you can expect to be blind. You can expect to have dementia and not even recognize the world around you, the people you love and everything. It's really, really important to control this blood sugar. And anyway, so when we don't digest well. We also produce ammonia. And that's because poor digestion usually means definitely poor digestion of protein. That means more ammonia. And if you list the 10 or 15 really nasty toxins that the body is always producing, ammonia is one of them. You know, homocysteine, excess histamine, excess glutamate is another one. There's a handful of them, but also ammonia is definitely one of them. So we create ammonia when we don't digest protein. And we get this very, you know, key to chewing food and digesting the food, chewing it so thoroughly so that the stomach doesn't have to work very hard, is really key for having a healthy gut microbiome too, because you will get an imbalance of microbes in your gut if you have inflammation, and poor digestion equals gut inflammation and also pain. Pain comes with it. You know, they know that women, when they have their period, have much more sensitivity in their gut. So they're more likely to, you know, be upset if they eat wrong. So that's another time when women should be quiet and still. And when they eat foods are easy to digest, but also chew when they eat. So also poor digestion, you know, causes a lot of gas, and some people end up, it's a major cause of constipation that no one ever talks about either. So chewing activates the vagus nerve, which is a really, really important part of digestion, and then breathing activates the vagus nerve. In other words, we must breathe to get that vagus nerve relaxed, and it relaxes the colon then, so our digestion can occur. You know, we have that part of our nervous system called the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest and digest part. And when we're eating, that parasympathetic nervous system is supposed to be working properly.
Right.
And if the other side of that, of the nervous system, is the fight or flight, where we're running away from the stress or something like that, when everything shuts down. So you literally have to be in your parasympathetic nervous system to digest it all and to breathe deeply and relax that vagus nerve and connect the brain and the colon and the microbiome and all the things they're doing in there together. Now, the vagus nerve is often like, most of the time you ask people, what is the vagus nerve? They don't even know what it is. But it's really, really key to digestive health. And, you know, everybody's saying today, digestion is everything. Well, it's a big subject. And I always tell people, if in body ecology, we have 7 universal principles that I've always tuned into. And if I see something I need to learn about, or a new condition or something, I'll go to the principles and find the answer. Well, the principle of step-by-step is a really important principle because it tells you what you have to do. Like, that's your roadmap or your plan to put in place to get somebody well or to heal yourself. And you've got to create energy, because no one does anything without energy. And a lot of people are in a hole, and they have no energy. So they're stuck right there. They're not sleeping well. Their thyroid and adrenal are burned out or whatever. And so you got to work on that. You've also got to cleanse out toxins. That's part of the plan. You've got to conquer infections that you've got going on, especially yeast infections. These are so common, but maybe it's a Lyme infection or a tooth infection. You've got to conquer those and get them out of the way. They're sucking the energy out of your body. But the other thing is, you've got to correct digestion, and that's a really big bucket. Like, there's lots to say about digestion. And so people talk about digestive enzymes, and the microbiome is, you know, of course, hot now, but no one talks about simple things like chewing, breathing, relaxing, activating that vagus nerve. So, you know, I just wanted to point that out. Maybe hearing me, maybe, you know, sometimes you know things and then you're ready to act on it. And hopefully people listening are really thinking, okay, I'm going to chew 30 to 40 times.
It's just more information. It's more background than you say about the wage and all that. Because this is one of the principles I harp on people all the time is, you know, everybody's looking for the next great probiotic or the, the enzyme or the herb or what candida killer things they can do. And I always tell them you have to start. Digestion begins in your head, really, because you have to shift from sympathetic to parasympathetic. And once you do that, it's always breathe and relax before each meal. Breathe and relax before each meal. Chew every bite slowly. And it's great to hear some, you know, some weight loss things. That's an additional, like, bit of what I might call ammunition that we can use, or inspiration,
well,
motivation.
Science. Some people... We need the science to kind of believe it. But, you know, there's a hormone. So I did want to bring up some information about hormones, too, because that's another big missing piece that you never, ever hear anyone talk about much, or don't gut hormones. And there's a bunch of them, and I didn't want to talk about all of them, but there's one called ghrelin.
Yeah.
And it's called a hunger hormone. It makes you hungry. But so if you're not chewing and carefully and eating mindfully and resting and everything, that hunger hormone goes down and you're not as hungry, so you eat less. You're going to weigh less, and you're also going to – and that's the secret to longevity, you know. It's kind of really sort of practicing calorie restriction, not to overeat. We always say don't fill up the stomach more than 80%. Leave 20% for digestion. So this hormone, ghrelin, makes us hungry, and if you're chewing well, ghrelin doesn't go up. And so we're not, you know, like a lot of people are not eating mindfully. They're not chewing well. And then they aren't even aware that they're full, you know, because this hormone hasn't kicked in. And the other hormone too, leptin, L-E-P-T-I-N. That's another one that interesting because I've been, you know, looking at people's genes for a while now, and leptin is an interesting hormone too. There's a gene that, if you have that SNP, that genetic SNP, then a lot of people I've noticed have this SNP, and so therefore the leptin, which stops them from eating, like it sends the signal, stop, I'm full, stomach is full here, stop. That gene isn't working very well in people. So I think
what gene it is? What's
people are overeating. They're go ahead. Yeah, please.
Oh yeah, what's the SNP for that? Do you know? Do you remember?
You know, I don't. There's so many of them. I can't always.
I
can look it up real quickly though. Maybe even while we're talking to someone else talking or you're talking, I can quickly look it up. I think, well, it's the leptin receptor. I think it's just LEPR.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that's all it is. But
okay.
I would
cool.
definitely. Check it out for sure.
I'll look it up.
LEPR sounds
good. I thought you might know it off the top of your head. So, but yeah, that's good.
I should, but you know what?
There's so many of them.
Moving. There's a lot of them, and also, honestly, I have been moving for 3 months, and it's so stressful that my brain isn't as sharp as usual, and I'm just about ending the end. If I've had two back-to-back moves. It's so interesting to me that when you're stressed out chronically for a long time, what happens to your brain? Because things I know really, really well are like floating around out there.
I
think it's LEPR, leptin receptor.
That's good. Cortisol will damage the hippocampus, which affects your memory. So that's where, you know, constantly going back to what you said earlier, that breathing that brings us back from sympathetic to parasympathetic, that will turn on the prefrontal cortex. Whereas cortisol turns on the limbic system and the lizard brain.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes you're just in the middle of a crisis for some reason or other, and you really can't stop it. You have to keep on going. The stress isn't going to go away. I think that happens a lot today. And that's why a lot of the functional medicine doctors recommend heart math or meditation or yoga or some quieting thing, but just getting away from people and being quiet and still is also the other part of bringing yourself back into balance again, too. We don't do enough of that. It's hard to do that in our culture.
It is, and it takes training, and it took me years to be able to actually just do the heart math in every moment. You know, not every moment, obviously. But to, like, really be able to pull at it as soon as that stress comes in, to be able to go, okay, let's breathe into it. Let's breathe into it, you know? But it's interesting you talk about the ghrelin and the leptin, because one of the modules I'm working on right now for our nutritional endocrinology practitioner training is the endocrinology of appetite, which we should be releasing in a few weeks. And I've been really researching into the ghrelin-leptin combination and some others. There's some other hormones there. But, you know, what I wanted to talk a little bit more about, because you're so into the genetics and how it affects the gut. And I'd love to just, if you just have a few little things you want to talk about here in terms of the gut and the genetics. I know I've heard you talk about the FUT2 gene and a couple of other things that really affect like the microbiome and what probiotics are going to be living, or, you know, what organisms are going to be living in our guts.
Well, the biggies probably are the gluten 1, HLA, D2, and D8. And, you know, so a lot of people, not that many people have them, but, you know, I see people that are not healthy. And so there's a lot of, you know, maybe that out of every four, I see one person probably that has these genes. And so therefore they're going to strongly react to gluten. Then what happens is that the gluten stimulating is zonulin, and then that opens up the junction in the walls of the gut. So those people are constantly going to walk around with an inflamed gut. And that's, of course, everybody I'm sure listening knows how bad that is. Food, too, in case anybody has missed it, is most often called the B12 gene, because if you have food, too, you are going to be at risk for having low levels of B12. And all the B12 genes, in my opinion, are gut genes. For example, you have to have adequate levels of B12 to make stomach acid. And B12 deficiency truly is an epidemic. There's a saying that nobody actually gets out of this lifetime without being B12 deficient.
Really?
It's just, there's a great book that's been around for a while, but, you know, I don't know that it ever came out at a time when people were ready for it, but it's called Can It Be B12? And I highly would recommend that book, because B12 is such a critical enzyme, critical B vitamin for the methylation cycle. But getting back to B2, and then you don't make stomach acids, and then when you don't have stomach acids, you'll be deficient in B12, an intrinsic factor. So, you know, you'll have anemia and everything. It's a vicious circle. And then the FUT2 gene, though, it's got another important part to it, and that part is the fact that, you know, years ago when Dr. Peter Diadama wrote his book on the blood types, and then his next book, it was actually the second book, it was even the best book he wrote. And he talks about secretors and non-secretors. And I think he lost a lot of people at that point because it seemed so complicated. But basically, it's just as simple. We all have a different blood type. Like, I'm an A. Are you an O, Winnie?
No, I'm a B negative.
Oh, B. Yeah, that's such a nice balanced blood type. I would think you would be a B. But so if you're whatever your blood type is, A, O, you know, B, whatever, we all have sugar molecules in our blood, and we secrete those molecules into our saliva, in our mouth, into our tears, into our skin, and into the gut microbes. So if doggy or barking when I was walking by. Let's go back to the mouth again, since we started there. If you secrete your blood sugars into your saliva, and you are a non-secretor. In other words, you're not secreting your A or B or O blood sugar into your saliva, you're going to have a lifetime of gum and teeth problems, because you don't have the bacteria growing in your mouth to protect you from those kind of bacterial infections. So that is actually a big deal. But saliva, you know, skin, I mean, no, that's important too, because you want to have the right kind of bacteria in your skin. You know, cheers. But the big one also is the gut. And if you're not secreting your blood sugars into your gut, you don't feed your bacteria. Most of all, you don't feed your bifidus. Now, the reason this is just so extremely important to know about to me is that at the very beginning of our life, we always talk about, you know, how the microbiome gets established. Believe it or not, no one talked about that years ago. I was the first one, and it wasn't very, it wasn't anything available on it. I just kind of logically deducted some common sense things, but, you know, bifidus is the first bacteria that shows up. Now there's tons of research, so what I'm saying, I know it's to be very accurate, is that bifidus is our first bacteria, and it's particularly for the first 6 weeks, bifidus in sandfish shows up, and who knows why certain ones show up in the beginning. I personally have a theory that infants are particularly good at cleansing, because I've had colon therapists over the years, when I would suggest to people that they take infants, you know, bifidus infants, which you can buy from a company like Natron. They sell just infants under a brand name called LifeStart. And if you buy that and put somebody on it and they go for a colonic, the colon therapist would always tell me how much black, nasty stuff they would release. So I used to suspect that infants was a cleanser. And then I think, well, why wouldn't it be? Because the baby is eating throughout the pregnancy. You know, he's swallowing the amniotic fluid. He's getting nutrients. There is a stool in a newborn baby. And so I believe that infants has that purpose. But again, there's no science on that. But the bifidus is very, very important. You know, there's more of them come into the gut. During the first 6 weeks, they rule. After a while, the baby's gut changes and becomes like the mom's. And so that's why they say the mom, you know, she vaccinates her baby. I've said that for years. We don't need to vaccinate. This is how we should be vaccinating. Our moms vaccinate the babies. Besides handing down their genes, they're handing down their microbiome for generation after generation after generation. But, so they're feeding this bifidus bacteria with their breast milk, hopefully. And guess what? If you're a non-secretor, your breast milk won't have the sugars to feed the bifidus. And the baby most likely inherited that gene. There's a very good chance mom has it, particularly if she's homozygous. For sure, the baby's going to have at least one copy. So the baby's own sugar molecules are not feeding his own gut. So I honestly, you know, and studying all the different microbes, and there's some really important ones. There's something I wanted to share with everybody that they hadn't heard it yet. That I learned from Dr. Leo Gallen, come back to that. But, you know, I just have come to so there's a lot of important microbes, but I really think following nature, doing things just the way nature did it, even if we don't fully understand why, is very important. And that bifidus shows up first. It's always an important bacteria. It's very important for constipation. I think these are the same people that are chronically constipated from birth. So I've had people take bifidus strains, like Renew Life makes one called LifeStart. We have one coming out too soon, but Custom Probiotics makes one. You can't really get bifidus usually just by itself. You know, they always want to put lactobacillus and a bunch of other bacteria into it, but you can get bifidus to get more of it. Put it in your drinking water, like take a bottle of water and drink it all day long with bifidus in it.
Oh.
I've had so many people tell me that made a huge difference. These were the non-secretors, the ones with the FUT2 gene. They said it made a huge difference for a while. But, you know, like everything you do in the beginning, it makes a big difference. The body's happy to have it, and then it kind of levels out because the body gets used to having it. And then you have to do more than that. That's right. Like one thing never fixes everything.
But that's a good,
this is a really, really important one. It's fixing the gut, and it's feeding that bacteria. And what I just shared with you, very few people know it, very few. So it's a good thing to know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I appreciate you mentioning that because, you know, as I think back, you know, we always try to apply this to ourselves. There's several different variations on the FUT2 gene. Every single one of mine is homozygous. So I don't secrete at all. And I go back and I had a lifetime of dental problems, even after I changed my diet, continued to have not such great teeth. My father had horrible teeth. I had, you know, a miserable time with my gut throughout my life. And it's just really like it makes total sense given that that I'm not a secretor. So it just says, you know, no matter what I'm eating, how good I'm doing, I do have to really be careful about making sure that I'm getting plenty of that bifidus.
Absolutely. Oh, that's really good. That's a great example. Well, yeah, so let's see. MTHR is important. That's methylation. All those B vitamins have to be in there to have a healthy gut. But the other thing I wanted to talk about, and this probably especially fits in with your new the module, I guess you're offering, you call it a module about the endocrinology of the gut and all, is that we have this group of hormones called incretin hormones. Mm-hmm. And they have, there's two of them I particularly wanted to talk about because they're very interesting to me. So what's a hormone to begin with? I mean, some people never really thought that through, but the simple definition is a hormone is it's just a molecule that's released from one site and it acts somewhere else. Like estrogen, for example, is released in the ovaries or the adrenals, but it doesn't act, it goes out of there and acts in lots of other places in the body, including the gut. And people are not clearing estrogen out of the gut. That's a big deal because they don't have the right microbes in their gut. I mean, we're so, such a big problem with estrogen today if you don't have a healthy gut. But so I actually think that I like to look at the hormones that are particularly related to estrogen, like 1B1, 3A4, 1A1, because if I can see that MTHFR, I can see that person is going to have COMT, COMT. That person's, you know, already at risk for hormone problems. Right. Then they don't have a healthy gut, and they've got these gut hormones that are not working right. To me, looking at those, estrogen hormones are also part of a healthy gut. Like they're, you know, the thing about genes is people will look at one gene and learn about it and think that this is how you fix this gene, and they don't realize the art is really in the connection of all these genes, and that takes obviously a while to learn, but there's too many people looking at one gene and treating one gene.
Right.
But to me, if you have a gut problem, or you don't, no matter what, if you have an estrogen issue where you're not clearing estrogen, you need to be really mindful of what's happening in your gut. So that's kind of all I want to say about those kind of hormones, you know, because we always think of estrogen, testosterone. When people say hormones, they immediately go there.
Right.
But the gut hormones, that I've been kind of playing or trying to study and learn and think about are these ones in a particularly special class called incretin hormones. And there's something I want to share with you there, too, that I dug out. You know, sometimes you just stumble on amazing information that's kind of a game changer.
Yep.
Well, I made a little note to myself so I remember to tell you all this. So these incretins, they have names like GLP and GIP. And you don't need to remember their formal names if you can just remember GLP and GIP. And they're secreted or released from these specialized cells in the gut and also in the pancreas, too. So they're hormones, they're gut hormones, and they're released after we eat from the gut cells. And what happens with these two particular ones, which is why they fascinate me, is that they cause an increase in insulin from the pancreas, like the insulin releases. Pancreas releases insulin. So what happens is our glucose now can get into the cells and give the cells energy. And of course, the insulin is lowering that blood glucose because if the glucose stayed out in the bloodstream, that's very dangerous. You know, that's why people, again, I'm always thinking, what are the most important things to really focus on? Because there's so much that you could focus on. And I just think controlling blood sugar is so critical, which is why these hormones fascinate me. But, you know, so they increase insulin, so they lower the glucose and get it into the cells better. And then problems like, you know, going blind and Alzheimer's, kidney damage, getting old much faster. These are the people that age super fast. And this is what feeds cancer. You know, we all have cancer that comes and goes, but if you're feeding the cancer, it's going to come and stay. So it's just so important to be mindful of like these hormones are very much controlling insulin and our blood sugar. Now, the other thing they do is they slow down stomach emptying. Now, yeah, kind of have to think this through a little bit too, because if we didn't have them in there and we ate, you know, chewed up hopefully really well, chewed the food up and went into the stomach, what if it just like went through the stomach and 30 minutes. Fruit does, by the way. Fruit goes through the stomach very quickly, which is why we've always said don't eat fruit. Always eat it alone because it takes no time to clear the stomach. But proteins, fiber, you know, vegetables, carbohydrates. Everything else takes as much as 3 hours. And then another 3 hours in the small intestine too. But what's slowing down that stomach emptying? You know, like, what if it emptied in 15 or 10 minutes? We'd really be in trouble. Because, the stomach, after it, well, it doesn't do much, actually. I think a lot of people think a lot of things are going on in the stomach. Not too much is going on in the stomach. It's not a really great source of a microbiome because it's so acidic in there. But that stomach acid is very, very important for killing parasites in our food. Mm-hmm. And we always have parasites in our food. You can buy the healthiest organic lettuce or even sprayed lettuce, whatever. And they probably have more parasites, I would guess. But you know, you wash them off, you think nicely. I mean, who really washes their stuff that well? And the parasites are invisible anyway. Like another thing you can see if you put a microscope on the view tube of a colonic, therapy machine and you've been projected up on a screen, you may not see anything coming out of the person, but you'll look up there and you'll see lots of little teeny tiny parasites coming out. They are microscopic and we can't see it. So those can and often do, multiply inside of us, and they also, grow bigger and can stay there for decades. So, killing stomach acid is really important. It controls that H. pylori that isn't necessarily a bad guy. It can become bad and it can cause, stomach cancer and stomach ulcers and everything. But, also I learned from, Dr. Martin Blaser that since 1990, people are not being born with H. pylori anymore. H. pylori is on the list of missing microbes that he writes about in his book. Mm-hmm. It's called Missing Microbes. And so it's not a bad thing. It's even got beneficial value to it. But stomach acid helps control that. So people without stomach acid are the ones who are likely to have the overgrowth of the bad H. pylori that causes the ulcer that leads to stomach cancer. So that's important, of course. But only water is absorbed in the stomach. Of course, when you drink alcohol, that's absorbed in the stomach. And they found that aspirin is. I don't do aspirin, so this is what I've read in the research, that is absorbed in your stomach. But the primary site for digestion really is the small intestine. And the other thing that happens in the stomach is absorption of minerals. Very, very important. So the small intestine and then to a lesser degree, the colon. And the colon's got a lot of B vitamins in it, so those are certainly important. But again, I think it's going back to these hormones, these two particular incretin, incretin hormones, GLP and GIP, these two hormones, I'm trying to talk slowly and I'm taking notes and so they're not too confusing because I found this topic confusing. But, they slow down the release of the stomach. They keep the stomach from emptying itself too fast, which is a very important function. And then they have an effect on our increasing insulin, so our blood sugar is balanced. Now, here was the special thing I discovered that I wanted to share with you because it's so amazing to me. You find this research that people have done. It's very solid research by a very well-respected group of researchers, and they report on it. But nothing ever happens to it. It just kind of gets dropped. And I thought this is an extremely important finding. So everybody knows, I think, at this point, serotonin is made in the gut. Actually, much more serotonin is made in the gut than in the brain.
Yep.
And of course, serotonin is really, really important, but I think everybody knows that. But what the researchers discovered that serotonin sits in cells right beside the insulin, side by side in the pancreas. And it's the serotonin that triggers the pancreas to release the insulin. So you've got to have a healthy gut, healthy serotonin levels too. I mean, it's another important thing to know about insulin is that this whole serotonin, I'm always trying to kind of correct misunderstandings about things. I think there's a big, big misunderstanding about eating carbohydrates. you know, the paleo movement in particular has made people think carbohydrates, or they're ashamed of eating them practically. But you have to realize that the paleo movement is a response from the previous movement where everybody was raw vegan and they were eating a ton of sugar, you know, agave and dates, and their protein was coming from nuts and seeds, which are very high in oxalates, and honey and all that. I mean, super high in sugar. People got really sick, so they swing over in the other direction, which we always do. We never seem to settle in the middle with balance. We swung way over to paleo, which, of course, is very good for lots of people, especially initially. But then a lot of people started getting in trouble, and they found they couldn't sleep, and they didn't feel good. They didn't have any energy. They felt depressed. And that's because we're not using the principle of balance, one of our seven principles, and it is about balance. So complex carbohydrates are, they have to be prepared properly, they have to be eaten properly, and they can then be very, very valuable, because that's, if you have a complex carb meal, if you have your carbs at night, and that can be, you know, starchy vegetables like acorn squash, butternut squash, sweet potato, or regular potatoes, you know, with lots of veggies or a nice soup or veggie stew, those kind of meals, minus the animal protein, will definitely help you sleep better. You are going to make more serotonin. And so getting back to, so then I made a note to myself, I'll be sure to cover, how to eat complex carbs properly so people will stop thinking of them as bad. They have to be prepared properly. You know, I've said for years, this is another one of our principles, our 80-20 principles, that you should keep them, you don't need many. We need a small amount in a meal. They should be about 20% of your meal, maybe 25, where 80% is just a lot of delicious vegetables. Colorful, wonderful root vegetables, dark green leafy vegetables, sea vegetables, you know, a nice raw cooked, a really nice variety, 80-20. And then don't eat the carbs with protein, because they're so hard to digest that way. They're much easier to digest when they're eaten with vegetables. Never eat carbs with fruit, which I see so many people do, that, you know, they have fruit for a dessert or something, or have it, you know, I see a lot of gourmet chefs offering meals that have everything mixed together, including fruit, and I just cringe because I know how fast fruit clears the digestive tract and how it gets bound up with the protein and the carbs and causes all this gas and bloating, and gas and bloating causes constipation and so on. It affects the brain. So don't eat carbs with protein, and don't eat carbs with fruit. Now, carbs do feed, you know, rice and oats, for example. We're crossing wheat and rye off the list completely because of the gluten. But rice and oats are interesting grains to me. I don't recommend them in the beginning and haven't for years because they have sugar in them and they will feed systemic candidiasis, the infection that so many people have. Quinoa and millet don't. I want to say something about them. Let me make a note to myself, too. That's important to share. Okay, and then, but, so the quinoa and millet, that's why they're in first stage, because they don't feed the yeast, they're high in protein, they're really honestly seeds. They're not really grains. But, so we don't add them in until you're ready to go to stage two. And stage two is when your symptoms have gone away and you're feeling much, much better, and your microbiome is established so that you can eat grains, because it's up to the microbes to eat them. And, you know, if you've been paleo for a long time and you suddenly one day say, okay, I'm eating grains tonight, your microbes are not used to eating grains. So they're going to take a little while to get used to this brand new food. They, you know, a whole bunch of new ones in there. They don't know this food yet. I always tell people, you know, start with a nice stew or a vegetable stew or a soup where you just add a little bit of the rice or the oats, and then, then give the microbiome a chance to look at it along with a bunch of veggies they already know about. And then they say, oh, okay, we'll figure this out. And in a few days, they're perfectly digesting them. So I think that's another reason why people say, well, I can't go back to them. And then they have to be prepared properly in the sense that they have to be soaked. You know, they have the phytic acid on them. Phytic acid is going to deplete your body of minerals, and that's a coating to protect the grain from being eaten up by other animals and insects, but it's not good for us. So smart, wise people of ancient times soaked their grain. So it was really interesting because for 8 years I was macrobiotic, and then I went over to Japan and studied with Lima Osawa, and she started the macrobiotic movement with her husband, so I decided I'm just going to go learn from her directly. And I did learn some very interesting things from her in almost 6 months that I was there with her. But one of the things I noticed after this long trip over to Japan from D.C., I was starving. I hadn't eaten anything, and I got there, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to have a healthy macrobiotic meal. Well, I got in there, and they did feed me, which is nice, but they gave me these teeny tiny little portions of everything. I could have eaten 10 times that at this point, but you know, they don't eat big meals in Japan. But the other thing that fascinated me when I walked in the door was there's all these pots sitting around, big buckets, with rice in them, different kinds of rice, and they've been soaking them. So I thought, well, we don't ever do that back in the States. We don't soak them. Well, now I think people do know, but back in those days, they didn't know. And so all those people that became macrobiotic and were eating this huge amount of 50%, you know, that was the deal, 50% of what you were supposed to eat on your plate if you were macrobiotic was brown rice. And some people, when they fasted you, we were supposed to eat 90%.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that didn't work for me or a whole bunch of other people. And then, of course, I met Dr. William Crook. I found out, like, millions of people I had candidiasis and started on the path that I'm on now, where I created a diet to conquer that infection. And of course, eating rice was wrong, oats was wrong, and so on. But I do know now how important it is to soak to remove the phytic acid. I always soak it. There is
for how long, you know, Donna, do you soak it? 24
about eight
hours. 8 hours.
No, just eight. Yeah, but you know, there's one company called True Roots.
Yes.
T-R-U and then R. Okay, they make an interesting rice. They call it sprouted. I'm sure what they're basically doing is soaking it. And the reason I like that rice, though, if you turn the package over on the back, if you're really in a hurry and it's sprouted like that or soaked, you know, you don't necessarily have to soak it for so long. But if you turn the package over around the back, you'll notice it says it comes in a special strain of rice called GABA rice. And GABA is, of course, the neurotransmitter that keeps us calmer. Very, very important. I think so many, there's another set of genes. Like you said, there's like 15 of them, but a lot of people have this GAD gene. I mean, they'll have quite a few of them that are yellow or red, one or two copies of them. And that GAD gene turns glutamate into GABA. And I see all these people now that can't turn their glutamate into GABA. So eating the GABA rice, I think, is a really good one. And I'll tell you, I've had people call me, and they weren't sleeping, and they were, you know, nervous wreck. And I can see, I didn't have a chance to look at their genes in those days, but I realized, you know, before we can start working on this yeast infection, we've got to get this person calmed down and sleeping. So I have them eat the GABA rice for 4 or 5 nights in a row with a bunch of vegetables, and it works. It's really great. So just a little extra tip to throw out there. Okay, so getting back to preparing them properly. So what I said was small amount, like the 80-20 rule. Eat them combined with lots of veggies, not with fruit or protein. You want to go with quinoa and millet because, you know, in stage one, if you have candidiasis, start with the grain-like seeds. Don't do the rice yet until you've got the microbiome established and your symptoms are gone. And then when you cook them, so you want to soak them, and then when you do cook them, they really are meant to be cooked a long time slowly over low heat. The way you might have done if you lived back, let's say, in Ireland, and you had this fireplace, and you had this pot going all the time, and you put everything in that pot, that you grew, or, you know, the grains, the oats that you had, you would keep them in there, and you'd be cooking those all day long. And they cook into what some cultures call a gruel, G-R-U-E-L, and some call it a porridge. But mm-hmm. that is the way to eat them. And whoa, what a difference it makes. And what a difference it makes for the microbes. Because, see, another benefit of eating grains is that they hold moisture into the colon. Like a lot of people are constipated because they just don't have enough, besides fiber, which they provide, they also have to have enough moisture. Like we get real dehydrated in our gut. You cut open the gut of somebody really old after they've died, their gut is so dehydrated. So eating, particularly if you slow cook them, like I just mentioned, into a porridge like that, you're eating all that wonderful fiber with all that moisture that's going to hold in the gut, keeping the gut more moist. You'll see that in your skin even. And then the other thing I like to tell, a thought popping in my mind and add about slow cooking them with a lot of vegetables. Like you can slow cook them all day long and then toward the last hour or so, put in some chopped vegetables and keep on, or, you know, 2 hours, whatever, and keep on. Add sea vegetables too, you know, salt. You always want to add salt because they're acidic. So you want to add the salt, which is alkaline. And there you are using an important, this is important. We talk all the time about food being medicine. It's not medicine unless you know how to cook it, prepare it properly. And so something acidic like a grain has to be balanced with something very alkaline like salt. So always put in about a teaspoon of salt per cup that you're cooking. And then don't be afraid of salt. It's quality that's important. Like another gene that you can look at called the salt sensitive gene. Pretty many people have this gene and you know, everybody's always arguing like, is salt good for you or not good for you? Well, number one, the salt that's out in the world in all of our processed food is not good for anybody, especially people with the salt sensitive gene. And so they should avoid processed foods at all costs. Otherwise, they can have a high quality sea salt, if they stay under about a teaspoon a day. And that's still a significant amount. Like you might put a teaspoon into a cup of rice or oats, cook them all day long, and you're not going to eat the whole pot and eat up that whole teaspoon of salt in one. I mean, if you ate the whole teaspoon, that's okay. But that's kind of the limit for even somebody who's real salt sensitive. My favorite salt comes from Selina Naturally, S-E-L-I-N-A, Naturally. And they are the ones who brought Celtic sea salt over here. The first people to have good quality Celtic sea salt were the macrobiotic people. Her father-in-law, Jacques Delandre, brought Celtic sea salt over here. And, of course, they sell the Celtic salt and always have, but they have a new salt now called Makai, M-A-K-A-I, that comes from Hawaii, way below the ocean, so it's super pure. But I love this salt because it's higher in potassium than it is in sodium. And I think people with that, if you don't know if you've got a salt-sensitive gene or not, you're really wise to use the Makai salt. Now, it's not on the market. Like Celtic salt, you can almost buy everywhere, but the Makai salt, you have to, look them up, selinanaturally.com, and order that. Where's some of my own notes here? There have to be, go ahead. You want to ask me a question?
I was going to just ask a question, but go ahead. Go ahead.
On with my list of preparing them properly. You have, besides slow cooking them over a low heat for a long time, you want to eat them with fermented vegetables. Now, you know, the microbes in the vegetables eaten with a meal are going to be traveling through your digestive tract with that food, and they're breaking down proteins into amino acids and fats into fatty acids and carbs and all. They're breaking everything down like they're supposed to. And they, if it's a sugar and they can get fiber from it, that is their favorite food. Fiber is the food, the most heavenly food of all for the microbes in your gut. So you got to have some carbs. You got to have some healthy, complex carbs in your diet prepared properly. And, of course, you don't have to worry if you're, I mean, eat the fermented foods with the cultured vegetables. Now, I did want to add one little thought that I popped in my mind yesterday about this. Is everybody, everywhere I look online, people are talking about sauerkraut, sauerkraut, sauerkraut. Well, you know, it's like years and years ago when I started teaching, there were no fermented foods in the country except one man was selling yogurt and it was considered a hippie food. No one ate it hardly, but There were no other fermented foods, believe it or not. People that came over from other countries just didn't bring them with them, and we didn't have them in our culture. We had sauerkraut, but you'd walk in the store, you'd buy this jar in the health food store. It would have vinegar, it would be pasteurized, and it would have citric acid and all, and it wasn't alive. And the Ann Wigmore's group had just been getting into veggie kraut when she passed away, and, you know, that never really got picked up there. But she was from Europe and knew about them and thought they were important. She was just kind of getting into them when she, you know, stopped doing her work and on and died. But what I wanted to say about them is that, so back in the days, I started using the term sauerkraut, and people would come to me and they'd have bought the wrong, they went into the store, they bought sauerkraut. It wasn't anything like I was talking about. So I decided I can't use this term anymore. I've got to get a better term, a more appropriate term. And that's where I came up with cultured vegetables, which is actually a very popular term. Lots of, you can Google it and YouTube. People, a lot of videos on YouTube on it today. But, the thing is, the reason they're better is because they have more than just cabbage in them. Like sauerkraut traditionally is just cabbage. And fermented vegetables, cultured vegetables, are usually a variety. Like one of my favorite recipes is cabbage with kale, green cabbage and kale. Then I put in fennel, which is great for digestion, mint, which is great for digestion, and onion. If it's summertime and I can get a sweet summer onion, I'll use that. But any onion works. And then I take my blender and my high power blender and I put a couple of red apples in there, the sweetest apple I can find, because I'm not going to get the sugar in that apple. My microbes are. So I put the apples in there and put in our starter, our lactobacillus starter, our lactobacillus plantarum. And I put in some food for them, and I always put in humic minerals. We have these liquid minerals that I always put in there. They love those minerals. They're earth minerals, and that's what we call ours, ancient earth minerals. They adore those minerals. And so if you feed them, they're going to, you know, not just grow up and multiply. They're going to be super duper hardy as they grow and multiply, and there'll be lots more of them because they're so hardy. Well, anyway, so that's why I put all that in the blender. Like I have both blenders, the Vitamix and the BlendTec, and I actually like both of them. But, I'll puree all that together, and then I pour that over my shredded veggies, mix that all together with my hand, pack it in a jar, and that's it. I've got 9 or 10 jars that are going to last me for weeks, even though people come over and take my jars all the time, and I'm always giving them away, and everybody at my house eats them all, and they go fast at my house. They still last for a while, and I usually make up maybe 3 or 4 different recipes at a time. They're really better for you because they have the tremendous diversity. And first of all, they have a huge diversity of nutrients because you have cabbage, you have kale, and you have mint and fennel and onions and apples and all those, you know, fruits and vegetables. They have their own set of nutrients, but they all grew somewhere in a garden or farm or something. And every single one of them had their own unique microbiome. So if you're bringing in 3 heads of cabbage and a big bunch of kale and a couple of apples or whatever, you are, you're having all these microbes, lots and lots and lots of different ones. That's what you're putting inside of you. That's what you're making. That's what you're growing out. So you're getting that really, really important diversity that we're, and some soil microbes too, by the way, because they came from the soil, that we are finding are so important today the more we study the microbiome. And then I wanted to, also say that sometimes for years I've had people say, well, you know, Donna's just selling culture because she wants to make money. And, of course, I always want to make enough money to stay in business and keep doing the work I do, but that is not ever the number one thing that motivates me ever. I just happened to stumble across some very important information about the bacteria in those packets that we sell. So I want to tell you about the bacteria because, again, this is a very little known fact. That phone is ringing. I don't know how to turn it off. Plantarum, which is the bacteria in our, that's in our packet, is such a special bacteria. I think have all begun to hear about oxalates and how damaging they are in the body, well, they eat oxalates. And for most of us, we don't have that bacteria, the oxalobacter ferruginase, to eat the oxalates. So we have to rely on other bacteria to do it. Infantis, that I mentioned earlier, is a good oxalate eater. But Plantarum is a fantastic oxalate eater. And Plantarum actually makes folate. And for people that are studying the genes and the MTHFR genes and how we need to eat dark green leafy vegetables, you're getting a bacteria inside of you that's going to make folate right down in the gut. The Plantarum degrades histamine. A lot of people are having histamine issues because that can be a toxin. I mean, we have to have it. It's essential, like glutamate is essential in order to make GABA. But histamine is essential to make stomach acid, or histidine rather. And histamine protects us, it protects us from pathogens coming into the gut. So we have to have histamine, but we can't have too much of it. So there you have this meal that you've just eaten. And if you tend to produce high levels of histamine because you lack a gut enzyme like DAO, and there's another couple ones too, but they, the lactobacillus plantarum degrades histamine. It breaks it down for you. They're antiviral, so if you ever get, infected in your gut with the virus, so we have an entire virome in our microbiome, not just bacteria. There's all kinds of other creatures living in there too, including a virome. And then it's also antibiotics. If you have to take an antibiotic, let's say you have a bladder infection, it's just not going away, or strep throat or something, you end up having to take it. Most of the antibiotics won't kill Plantarum. It's one of those extra hardy organisms. Now, I also wanted to tell you what Leo Gallen, I invited him to be on the Gut Summit again this year. And he's the sweetest man. He's been around 30-something years studying the gut, studying parasites. He's just a really special man that introduces great stuff to the world. And he's humble and caring. Well, he was really excited. He wrote me back right away. And he said, I have something important to share. And so I couldn't wait until we got on the phone together and started talking. But here's what it was. So he said, you know about Alexander the great leader, that conquered half the world and everybody followed him because he was Alexander the Great. They just followed him. He said, think about this. In a gut where you have trillions of microbes, how do they know what to do? Well, there are certain organisms in the gut that the other ones follow. They're the leaders. They're the Alexanders. And so he calls them the Alexander organisms. This is a really important concept. I hope that you share this with a lot of people and give him credit for, creating this, bringing this out there. But so Plantarum is an Alexander organism. It's doing all these wonderful things. And he or she, I always give him a name. I always think of them as a male or female. I, for some reason, think of Plantarum as feminine. But a super warrior kind of leader that the other bacteria follow. So that's really important. So we don't just put the bacteria in a packet. We want you to put it in your veggies, get all these wonderful benefits, grow out the Plantarum. Plantarum is naturally present on vegetables and fruits anyway, because that's what Plantarum means, plants, that comes from plants. But you don't get nearly enough unless you add it and then grow it out. So those are kind of my I just started making little notes thinking, what can I say today that might be valuable and interesting? And if I were face to face with everybody, I would love to see for us all to be talking about this stuff.
Yeah. So, you just threw together a few notes and you were able to talk for over an hour. So that's pretty cool.
Oh, and my goodness. Over an hour.
Awesome. Yes. Yes. Aww. And it's been just delightful to listen to you. The one question that came up earlier for me that I wrote down was when you were talking about grains, I was thinking resistant starches because I thought you were going to tie in how they say to
cook them and then put them in the refrigerator. So I just was wondering if you had any opinions about, there's a lot of hullabaloo or a lot of talk out there about resistant starches.
Well, I think that you have to, I'm not clear, certain about this, so I would rather, you know, other people go look this up. But I think when I looked into resistant starches, I always felt they were either too sweet, like, you know, maybe would feed the yeast, or they have can be high in oxalates too. So that's a big deal. You don't want to have a diet high in oxalates. But, again, that's something I have to check out. Sometimes I learn things and just don't retain it forever. But I remember thinking that, well, this resistant starch thing, it's kind of overhyped. And what's wrong with eating grains? If people understood how to eat them properly, how to prepare them, how to eat them, and, of course, don't hesitate to use enzymes, particularly the enzymes that are called plant enzymes that have protease, amylase, lipase, and so on. Like we sell three different types of enzymes for a purpose. There's one enzyme that works in the stomach and starts digestion of protein. There's one that's working in the small intestine, because you really have to support digestion in the small intestine. That's where most nutrient absorption takes place. And then when you're having an evening meal, which in Body Ecology is a plant-based meal, no animal protein, then these plant-based enzymes are excellent. Oh, and that reminds me, I almost forgot to say this, even though we're over time. Quinoa and millet are high in oxalates. They are seeds. Like you don't want to have chocolate and spinach and soy, unfermented soy and nuts and seeds. Those are sweet potatoes, super high in oxalates too. So what that worried me, because I knew how valuable they were and the fiber they provided. And one day I just started thinking, oh, well, here's the answer. You take your quinoa and soak it out of your millet, you know, soak it, like you wash it off and soak it. Oops, wait, I've got to tell you something after this too. Make a note. So you take, you clean them up a little bit, rinse them really well, soak them for a while, and then when it's time to cook them, get a big pot of water cooking on the stove as if you were going to make a pot of spaghetti noodles, pasta. And so when the water's all hot, you pour your quinoa in there. And, of course, you've got this big pot of water and these teeny little grains floating around like crazy. Looks silly. But they're floating around. And then cook them for about 12 minutes, 15 if it's millet. And then at the end of that time, take your pot over to the sink, pour off most of that water, and then catch the quinoa or millet in a little strainer with a hole, you know, small holes. Now, it's very light and fluffy. Like, you'll make very, the little seeds separate and makes great. They're not mushy or stuck together, so it's great if you want to turn them into, like, a quinoa salad or a millet salad. And I always say make enough that you can have them hot and fresh one night, and then the next night, you know, make them into a salad for lunch next day or so. Or but what you've done anyway is you've poured the many of those oxalates have left in that water, gone down the drain, so you've lowered the oxalate content to medium or even a low oxalate food. Now, you can do the same thing with sweet potato. I don't recommend sweet potato in the beginning because it's so sweet. Most people bake it in the oven. If you bake something, it brings out the sugar in it, and also then they'll stick it in aluminum foil, and that's even awful. I mean, what an awful thing to do. But if you want to eat a sweet potato, the best thing to do is, you know, cut it into little cubes and pieces, and then put some water on to boil, a pot of water, and then put them in there with some salt and start cooking them until they're real soft. Pour off that water, and you're pouring off a lot of the oxalates that are on them. Mash them up with a little bit of butter, unless you have the APOE4 gene, then you do not want to use butter. But, you know, just mash them up and eat them that way, or eat them in the chunks. But this is just, sure, coconut oil definitely seems to be a better choice for APOE4. But, you know, that's the genotype that really needs to be more vegetarian. But the thing is, there's the same people calling. I'm sorry, from Australia. I just want to say one more thing, though, because I know everybody has to run. Oats, they're really wonderful for you. And they need to be cooked with salt. They need to be soaked. But I love for people to eat oats because I think that a lot of people benefit from them. And they've got that calming factor. They're hold a lot of fiber and water into the stool. But people are eating oatmeal. I would never, never touch oatmeal because in order to make the oatmeal for us, they bring the oats in, they slice them up and stick them in a box or a package. They are so dirty. They have eggs and parasites and just dirt on them. Unless you're into eating dirt, you know, I mean, that's the title of a few new, couple of books are out lately called Eat Dirt or something similar to that. You know, so maybe you want to eat oatmeal, but I don't like the thought of eating something so nasty. So I always tell people, buy the whole oat groat.
Right.
Soak them in, you know, clean them off and soak them like we just mentioned, cook them real slowly. You will, you can control, you'll be able to determine if they're dirty or not if you use the whole oat groats. And I think looking over my notes, I covered everything.
You covered everything so beautifully. And yeah, we are running out of time. We have a couple of minutes if anybody has a question or if you still have time. But I had one question one comment I wanted to make when you were talking about the GLP, you know, because I always think about, you know, everything has an upside and a downside, right? So if GLP and GIP are important for slowing down stomach emptying and increasing insulin, if we have too much of them, too little of them is obviously a problem, but if we have too much of them, then for someone who has insulin resistance, that increasing the level of insulin could be a problem, right? And also having food sit in the stomach for too long and delaying gastric emptying. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but those were the thoughts that came up as you were talking about it, because we talk a lot about, oh, not having enough of these incretins, but what about if we have too many?
I think that's much less likely to be a problem because if the gut, if you don't have a healthy gut, you're not going to be producing these. Maybe they come from specialized cells in the gut and in the pancreas. So if the gut's not healthy and it's inflamed and all, you won't be releasing these gut hormones. So I've actually never read anything about an overabundance of them. Of course, the answer will always be it's about balance. But
right.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's not even much research on that. That might be something worth. But I've never, ever heard anyone talk about that. The problem is usually the other way around. We have gut problems for all kinds of reasons, right?
Right.
So
the reason I thought of it was because there's pharmaceuticals that are now being targeted to increase them. And where we can get
in trouble.
Right? Because a little bit is good and too much is even better. Yeah, so that's what I was thinking, you know, where some of the pharmaceuticals that might be targeted there might be creating a problem in the other direction. So just something to think about in research. Yeah.
Well, yes, and then here's something you just reminded me of something. A lot of people have heard about DPP-4. As a matter of fact, I used to have one of my enzymes for the small intestine used to have DPP-4 in it. One of them did. I don't know which one of the two. And I took it out right away once I learned this, and that's because that enzyme, DPP-4, actually inactivates GLP and GIP. You know, people don't know anything about gut hormones. Everybody in the autism community was saying how important GPP-4 was to these children so that they could digest gluten. And so people were putting it in their enzymes, and then I stumbled across this important information. You know who's a really good person to follow is Mike Mutzel. He wrote a book, and he knows a lot about the gut hormones, too, and there's a bunch more to study. But, you know, it's kind of like the genes. It's overwhelming if you think, oh, my gosh, I can't learn all this. But if you just take out two or three of them, maybe just the ones through the gut, that's a good place to start, I think, or the ones to do with energy. Then, learn just those, and then you won't feel so overwhelmed anymore.
Yep.
Same thing with these gut hormones. There's a, you know,
it's
complicated. And of course, what's GLP and GIP and, you know, which is which? It's kind of like yin and yang. People think, well, which one's the yin and which one's the yang? So better to learn in little bitty pieces. And now we know that these two are important, and you got to have a healthy gut to have them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And going back to, for our people who are listening in who are in NEPT, we have, that's the other module I'm working on, is the endocrinology of digestion. So we're going through all of those hormones, and we will like introduce them a little at a time. And Mike was also one of our speakers on this series, this post Shine series, and he spoke at Shine. And he did mention about DPP-4 and how it affects these gut hormones negatively.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Rita Marie, I just have to tell you, you amaze me all the time. I don't know anyone that's offering classes on these topics. There's a ton of people out there offering tons of information. I'm sure it's overwhelming for people, but you have, from the beginning that I've met you, offered really important classes for people, for professionals. I mean, I think you're over the head of what I call the Oprah Winfrey crowd, because they couldn't even, you couldn't hold their attention for 5 minutes. But for somebody that really wants to learn, your programs are amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, we work on that because I think it's so important, all the things you said today, it's so important to just be aware of all the little things, because as we're trying to help people and they seem to be doing all the quote unquote right things, if you don't really understand all this gut, the gut hormones, the gut genes and all this other stuff, it's really hard. You can say, well, I don't know what else to do. You're doing all the right things. You're eating fermented foods. You're eating good vegetables. But if you don't have the understanding where you could dig in deeper, then you can't really help as many people. And I think that with the complexities of our world today and how much toxicity there is and how much stress there is, we're seeing more and more people with more and more complex problems. And it's not just as simple as saying, what we used to be able to say. And yeah, you can take people who are the Cheetos and Oreos crowd and easily get them 80% on their way with the diet lifestyle stuff. But then it's those when you have to factor in the damage to the gut mucosa, the lack of the hormones, the genes being out of whack and not conducive. There's a lot more we have to know. So, I'm dedicated and to getting that information out there. So I appreciate your comments about it. And I appreciate your dedication to what you're doing and all the research you're doing and bringing this stuff out to the world and bringing experts out to the world talking about these topics, like on your Gut Summit. I mean, people are talking some topics that are pretty heavy duty for the general public to pick up, and people are becoming so aware. So I appreciate all that you're doing to get that stuff out there.
Thank you. Well, I don't think either one of us could not do it. It's sort of our passion.
No, it's what we're listening
feels exactly the same way. They couldn't not be here learning.
Exactly. Yeah, so just a couple of people had comments. Like Steph said, she can't get on the phone because of her loud puppies, but she wants to thank you very much.
That's sweet.
And then
loud puppies, too.
Yeah, I know. Mine, fortunately, was quiet this time. But Steph thinks that says nopal cactus is high in resistant starch, which might be a good choice for insulin resistance because of, its effect on blood sugar. Diane wants to know, is there a test to find out if you're a secretor? I mean, I know there's the gene, right? So, which is the FUT gene, and you can do that with the 23andMe or some of the other tests that are out there. But is there a test to if you're actually a secretor?
You can go right to Peter Diodamo's site, and he's got a test kit that I think it's like $25. No, maybe it's $100.
Oh.
But
okay.
You can send that in and get just that tested for yourself. And this is a good site to go look, read about non-secretors. He's very technical. He's definitely for healthcare professionals. I think he wrote that book, which is for the public, and then he lost the public after that. But he's still gone on to do some great research. And blood type, there is research showing that blood type does matter. For example, A's tend to have ulcers more likely in their stomach, and O's more likely to have an ulcer if they get one in their small intestine. And, there's interesting research on blood type. I knew Peter's father about 40 years ago, showing my age, but that's when I got into blood type. And I started asking everybody, what's your blood type, and observing. And when I started working with autistic children, I asked every mother, what's your blood type? What's your son's blood type? And I'll tell you, most of them are blood type A. And I definitely think, I told Sally Fallon that once, because she didn't believe in blood type, but she said, really, daughter, that's statistically very significant. I said, well, 8 out of 10 of the children, go talk to them yourself. I've got records, files, and most of them are blood type A. So, Anyway, yeah, I think blood type matters, and Peter Diodamos is another site to go learn from, too.
So thank you. That's really good observations and all, and I just really appreciate all the work you're doing and digging and pulling all these pieces from all different places. I don't see any hands up, so I don't think there are any questions. So, again, thank you. I know you're so busy with just wrapping up the Gut Summit and all the work you've had to do, and I just so appreciate you taking time out from your busy schedule to be with us today. It's been very much appreciated.
Well, always for you, Rita Marie. I love you and what you do, so, you know, ask anytime. I'll be there.
Oh, well, thank you so very much. Everybody, thank you. Let me open up the line so everybody can just, you know, express their thanks to you and, you know, give a big loud cheer for Donna. Lines are open, so thank you, everybody. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now, everybody. Bye, Donna, and thank you so much. I just so appreciate you.
Thank you.